concession number 11899, Mr. B.J. Edwards, Reel 3.
As I was saying, I can't actually recall during the period I was in Yongpeng, which was the worst part of the emergency, my OSPC, an officer in charge of police circle, who was a superintendent based in Kluang, about 30 miles, I suppose, from Yongpeng. But I can't actually recall him ever coming to Yongpeng. He might have visited once or twice. But certainly one didn't get the impression that one was getting any assistance or backing from circle headquarters. They weren't really in a position to give it, I suppose, because our operations, certainly in Yongpeng, our operations were really based on our local intelligence. We did get some intelligence, I think, from Circle at that time, but I think it was pretty limited. Most of our intelligence was homegrown, I think, at that time. We had a very good, as I mentioned earlier, very good DSM, and very good informers, actually, locally. And we operated with those quite successfully. The fact that we didn't get, I don't think, any meaningful support in the emergency sense from our circle headquarters didn't affect morale, didn't affect my morale, and I don't think it affected the morale of any of the... I mean, I had a couple of Malay inspectors and two European police lieutenants there with me in Yongpeng. And I don't think we worried about that at all.
What effect did the assassination of Gurney have?
I think it was seen as just another incident, really. I mean, I don't know, play down that, but I think if I can recall my own feeling at the time, I remember it well. The feeling that it was a most unwise thing to do for the High Commissioner to take that sort of journey at that time, because the emergency was bad then. It was a most unwise thing for the High Commissioner to do that sort of journey in his Rolls Royce up a jungle road to Fraser's Hill, which is a pretty jungly road up there. I mean, it's a main road in a way, but it's narrow and twisting also. To be so lightly escorted and to do it so openly struck me, I remember, as being rather foolish. But the fact that the High Commissioner had been murdered, of course, put the cat among the pigeons in a very big way. And I think it had much more effect. Maybe this is looking back on it, so it may not fair to say it. Much more effect at home in the UK. I mean, people in the UK at that time, I wasn't here, so I don't think were bothered too much about the Malayan emergency. I mean, it wasn't big news every day of the week or anything like that. It had been rumbling on for some time. But when the High Commissioner was assassinated, well, then it put the cat among the pigeons and made the UK government do something. I think it had a number of effects. Of course, it was obviously a jolt. I don't think it affected morale in any particular way. I can't recall it doing that to me anyway. But I think it did. It loosened the purse strings. It made equipment much more available, all sorts of equipment much more readily available. It got Templar out, of course, which was, the UK government really pulled its finger out, and was forced to pull its finger out, and take the Malayan emergency seriously after that. I mean, I think that really jolted the home government, possibly more than it jolted people out there at the time involved, you know, at close hand. There's no doubt about that. I mean, they leapt to it, and of course, as a result of that, the prime result of that, of course, was that we got Templar.
Did the effect of his coming have a perceptible effect on you?
Who? Templar?
Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, when Templar came, it was like a breath of fresh air. I mean, he he transformed the scene, absolutely transformed the scene. I mean, he was in a position to do it. Gurney had been a colonial civil servant, really. I mean, that's what he was, a colonial civil servant. He'd been in Palestine, I think he'd been High Commissioner, I think, in Palestine. I don't know where he'd been before that, but he was just a colonial administrative civil servant. And he was a... I presume he was as effective as High Commissioner as any other person with that background. I don't think he was ineffective from that point of view, but I mean, he didn't carry any clout with the UK government, no noticeable clout anyway, the UK government, any more than the governor of Kenya did or anybody else at that time, except that Himalaya had what was thought to be a bit of an emergency on by the UK government, wouldn't take too much notice of it. But when the High Commissioner was assassinated, I mean, obviously a blow to British prestige to have the governor of a colony have to be called High Commissioner in Himalaya. Assassinated. That, of course, was something that shook the UK government. And of course, when they got Templar out, of course, I mean, Templar was not in the position of being a colonial civil servant at all. He wasn't. He was a distinguished soldier, of course, but also a person of terrific drive and verve and original thought and far. Reaching thought too, thinking beyond the immediate future and everything, and it was of course it was, he was absolutely ruthless. I mean, say ruthless. I mean, he ruthless in getting what he wanted, and he was in a position to say that. I mean, he was in a position to say, "I want this, and it'll be done." No colonial governor could say that. I mean, they were senior civil servants, but Templar wasn't in that position. He had McGillivray, who was extremely capable, deputy high commissioner. He was a colonial civil servant, but a very very good one. Been in Africa most of his career. He really did very effectively carried on the civil work of government, civil administration of government. Although it had to mash in and mesh in very closely, of course, with the operations, very, very closely, and did under Templar's direction. He was a very good deputy to Templar, who took a lot of most of the burden of the civil administration of Templar. We couldn't have possibly have done that, because Templar was not only a High Commissioner, remember, he was Director of Operations. And of course, that was his primary role, really. And of course, he was in a completely different position from his predecessor, because I mean he could get what he wanted. I mean, he only had to say what he wanted and he could get it, and when he set up the operations directorate, of course, it was I mean, his word was law. I mean, there was no red tape about it. If he wanted something, he got it. If he wanted something done, it was done, and there weren't any sort of excuses to say that or it couldn't be afforded or this, that and the other, some reason they couldn't do it. If he wanted something, it was done. And that was a completely different attitude. So, oh yes, when Templar came, the whole thing started to motor in an entirely different way. The emergency started to be... one could see the end of the emergency when Templar... It took time. But when he came on the scene, you could see the end of the emergency. Whereas before that, I'm not saying morale was low, I don't think it was, but it was difficult to see how it would have been. Well, we always were confident it would have been overcome. But Templar took so many steps, not only from the military point of view and the operations point of view and securing equipment and the physical wherewithal to carry out emergency operations. I mean, you know, everything from choppers to improve communication with the police, to altogether better training for the army, for integrated command. I mean, to have a very, very closely connected command structure in the Director of Operations, which I played a very junior part in at one stage. All this was his way. I mean, it was a complete, that didn't exist before, it was a complete turnaround. But apart from that, of course, and going into the political area, which of course is, you know, just as importantly looking further ahead, he saw that we would have to speed up. We were always, of course, conscious that we were going to lead to an independent Malaya, that Malaya was going to get independence, and all our Malayan officers were being trained up for that. Maybe too slowly, but they were being trained up for it in all departments of government, and of course including the police. But Templar speeded that process up. I mean, he found time to think about the political implications of the future of Malaya, and he founded the idea. He started the ideas that this had to, he propagated the idea, I should say, that this had to be speeded up, that the time scale had to be shortened, and that training had to be given to local officers. Very keen on that. He was also keen on improving government services. He was keen on improving the social services, such as they were. They weren't very developed, obviously. But he started all that. He pushed along the idea of having the first, the vestiges, vestigial sort of parliament thing. He started that off, where it hadn't existed before. It had been a council, but it was not elected. And he started off with the first elections, in fact. I mean, it was under Templar that the first elections came. He pushed that, those sort of ideas along. And so he was, and he did this, of course, with the idea, and successfully, of obtaining the support, I must say, mainly of the Malays, to start off with, but also of many, many Chinese. It eventually didn't actually work out as he had wanted, and later on I think he became somewhat frustrated, but this was after he'd left Malaysia. That's another story. But he definitely was a very, very, was an outstanding chap, not only on the operational action front, but also on the thinking front. So he was a great chap.
Why did it not work out as it hoped?
Well, that was much later on, long after the emergency, but I think he, I mean, later on, of course, what actually happened was that Malaya did not become, and has not become, the sort of integrated, multiracial society. It's a multiracial society, all right, but I think Templar envisaged. Templar was a chap, I mean, you know, he was a marvellous chap, but I don't think he really understood that the Malays would always be the dominant race in an independent Malaya. Now, this may, I don't think it's right to say, I mean, I've got a lot of experience in Malaya, and I happened to be born there, but my father was there for many, many years. I'm still very interested in the country, obviously, but not so knowledgeable now. But the Malays would always be, they would see that they would always be, under the sultans, the dominant race in Malaya. And I don't think it's possibly fair to say that the Chinese and Indian Malaysians, as they're all Malaysians now, are second-class citizens. But They're not first-class citizens in the same way that Malays are.
That came out
very much in the 60s. That was long after Tantra had left Malaya, but I think he became rather disillusioned in that. But I think he didn't fully understand that had to happen, in fact.
Did Temple come round to your district and meet you personally?
Oh, yes, yes. And another thing about the... Very much so. I mean, he was an indefatigable traveller. Although headquarters in Kuala Lumpur, of course, but he was all over the place. All over the place.
What do you remember about his visit to you?
Well, I worked on his staff, of course, as you see from my record. But when I was in Yongping, he was down... he was down in Yongping. He was all over the place. And he was supportive and he knew exactly what was going on. He was well briefed by his staff, and that was part of our job, to brief him when I was on the staff. And that was very interesting.
Can we go on to that now? And can you describe in detail the work that you did for him?
Yes, I can. The staff was quite a small staff, stretch of operations staff. There was a major general who was the principal, called principal staff officer. He had a full colonel under him as a G1. There were two other levels of staff, quite small staff under that. One was at half colonel, another sort of G1 level also, which was a half colonel, a wing commander, a Malayan civil service officer of middle seniority, reasonably senior, fairly senior, and a police officer of the rank of assistant commissioner. That was the combined staff at that level, G1 level. And at the G2 level, this is the level that I was operating on, there was a major and a more junior MCS officer and an assistant superintendent of police, that was what I was at the time. So that was the level that we operated on. But that was a very interesting experience, actually, because it was really a sort of... liaison information gathering at my level, I'm talking about a liaison information gathering job. Anything that the DFO wanted, or the principal staff officer wanted on behalf of the DFO, any information that he wanted, the details of information, we might be required to get that. We might have to make arrangements for visits accompanying the DFO and, of course, the principal staff officer on visits, briefing people in the contingents, the police contingents. I'm talking from the police point of view now, but it could have been army or anything, because we're all together in this. What they wanted to see and what was required and what they had to lay on for them at the other end on visits. That sort of work, really, most interesting, because it gave one I was very junior at the time, really, but you had there a position, of course, of really power and influence, if you like to put it that way, completely out of kelter with your rank, really, because you'd get onto the CPO's office, chief police officer in a state. And you might talk to a staff officer there. You might even talk to the CPO. I might talk to the CPO, but mainly to a staff officer. And you wanted some information. It wasn't a question of it was difficult to provide, or it could be provided tomorrow, or wait a moment. It was provided. I mean, Templar was like that, and the PSO working for him, of course, was on the same wavelength, it was really rather interesting, because you could you just got this information, and and maybe put it into a report or into a note or something as to what was needed. It gave you access to a lot of to both to information, of course, and to areas of command, and that one wouldn't normally have got at that sort of stage. So it was one was acting with a lot of power to one's elbow, really.
Was Templer feared by his subordinates? Was he ruthless with them?
Well, he just wanted things done and done right. I mean, if people did them wrong, yes. I think they got a fairly stiff end of his tongue if they did them wrong. I think he inspired a lot of, I mean, in his staff, he inspired a lot of loyalty, tremendous loyalty, really. Because it was recognised that, I mean, you're working for an outstanding chair. I mean, such an able, high-grade type of chair. And it's always better to work for that type of chair in any walk of life. I mean, it doesn't matter what you're doing. And he provided leadership, of course. He provided leadership for the country and of course, for everybody working in the security services and in the armed forces. I mean, he really inspired the country. There's no question about that. I mean, he did an amazing job, I believe. Amazing job. No, I wouldn't say he was. I wouldn't say he was ruthless. He didn't brook any incompetence. But I can't actually recall. If that's what you're asking. I can't recall that he. And certainly nobody on the staff might have got some critical remarks from time to time. I know we did. Or you might ask something again, you know, did I want, you know, this come down, not from him actually, through his staff, but I want this, you know, and just clear that point out and get it clear, that sort of thing. I know that in the country, I'm thinking from the police point of view now more, I don't know much, I can't say from the army, because although we were working very closely with them, I can't recall instances of him getting rid of people. But I think that there were one or two cases, I'm just trying to recall them now, but I think there were one or two cases in the police where he had people moved on that he thought weren't up to the job. Not up to the job. And he that's the impression that he gained. I mean, in one or two cases, it might have been a bit unfair. But, I mean, there you are. I mean, he was operating under a terrific pressure. He was at... especially in war, of course, you do that immediately. And he operated like that... In malaria, it was an emergency situation, and if he thought somebody wasn't up to the job, he had him removed. I know he did that on a number of occasions. I can't actually recall any specific occasion, but I know it happened.
Before you did this staff job in 52, 53, you were at Malacca. How different was that from what you'd experienced at Yong Beng and Moore?
Quite different. Malacca was a sleepy hollow, really. It wasn't very much touched with the emergency. I did actually go to Jassin district for a short time. I was in Malacca town, which was just a sleepy hollow, as I say. Jassin was a bit different because Jassin was right on the borders of Johor. It was on the borders of my old circle, Moore Circle, actually, Jassin. And there was, at one part of the district, there was quite a lot of CT activity, communist terrorist activity going on. Other part of the district was a predominantly Malay kampong area. Everything was peaceful and beautiful. But Malacca, on the whole, no, was a sleepy hollow. The emergency in Malacca was a very mooted affair.
Because it was mostly Malay?
Malay, or practically all Malay area. I mean, there are a lot of Chinese, quite a few Chinese in Malacca, but I mean, and of course there are, rather extraordinary, you may know about it, but there are a lot of Chinese in Malacca who are called Babas, and these are quite different from the Chinese, the majority of the Chinese you find, or found, things are different now again after all these years, but you found in Malaya, the Barbars, who there are a lot of them in Malacca, had come to trade in Malacca under the Portuguese, and about this sort of time. And so some of them have been in Malacca for 300 or 400 years, whereas the average Chinese in Peninsula Malaysia, now from about just under 40% of the population, 35% of the population, of course, were immigrants who came over in the, well, mainly in the early years of this century, some in the last century, or certainly in the last two decades of the last century, in the early years of this century. When we were there, their fathers had very often come from China. Sometimes they'd come from China. The Barbars were quite different in Malacca. They were old established Chinese there. They'd not converted to Islam or anything. They hadn't, Masuk Melayu, they call it, or become Malays, but they were very, very. They were, in fact, a lot of them had been in Malaya longer than some of the Malays there, because a lot of the Malays, remember, along that coast, especially along that west coast, had that part of the west coast, both Johor and Malacca. But a lot of those Malays come over from Sumatra and from Java, in fact. So they'd really come from what is now Indonesia, and they'd been within the period that the Chinese had been there. So the Chinese are very well established there. And some of those Barbars are very interesting because some of them actually didn't speak any Chinese. Speak Malay.
And they were a peaceable community.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And the emergency didn't affect them, as far as I recall, at all. Malacca was just a rural retreat, a sort of a sleepy hollow, really.
And then after the staff job, you were at Kluang. Was there an emergency going on there?
Very much so, yes, yes. Moved down to Kluang. That was a district, of course, in Johor. I was OCPD there again, officer in charge of police district. That was from 54 to 56. And the emergency was... We're getting on top of the emergency then, but it was certainly an area where there was a lot of emergency in Kluang, a lot of incidents, and a hot area. But we were getting well on top. And by the time I left Kluang in early 56, really we'd done very well there. I mean, the security forces had done very well there, and we were getting the thing. You could see the end of the emergency coming off, and in fact, it did come off within a couple of years.